what I would like to do on your behalf is to welcome Jeff Hansey, who's going to talk to us this morning. And Jeff, as you can see on the programme, has a number of quite prestigious labels which he brings, and they're very well-earned labels. Jeff is a freelance writer who was originally a soil scientist, I believe. You might be about to say that. And when I met him more years ago than I care to remember, he was an agricultural extension person, working, having just set up food policy, the academic journal, and writing and working. And I've learned a lot about writing and presenting from Jeff over the years, as well as where good cafes and restaurants are. But in the last few years, his campaigning work, pioneering work, not attached to anybody, which is always a hard thing to be, not in an institution permanently, has been recognised. And he's had a number of awards, the Derek Cooper Awards, the Best Food Campaigner and Educator from the BBC Radio 4 Food and Farming Award, and also, much more importantly, not just the kind of public recognition, but actually has cash attached, which is the kind of award everybody likes, which is the Joseph Rowntree Visionary Award for a Just and Peaceful World, working for a fair and sustainable food system, which has given him, at last, the freedom, the capacity to write, talk, visit, and do the things that he really wants to do. He will tell you about why he's written a book called The Future Control of Food and how that came to be written. So I'm going to hand over to Jeff to speak to us now.
Rewriting the rules to secure our food future. Well, good morning and thanks. I was really pleased when I heard about the title for this conference, because for the last 10 years or more I've been working with people who make the global rules, which increasingly shape what we do, and global rules on patents and other forms of monopoly or exclusionary privileges. And I've been convinced that we've neglected the rules and the frameworks, and if we don't change those, many of the things we're working hard for will be more and more difficult to do, and to achieve the kind of fair and sustainable and vibrant food system we want. Another reason I'm pleased is because this is about bringing a voice for farmers from Africa, and it's not just from Africa, but from all over the world for farmers. Because when I started, we were trying to give a voice to governments from sub-Saharan Africa in the negotiations on the international treaty, let alone the farmers. And there is a dire need for more input into the government from farmers and into the international areas. But then I was really about terrified to be asked to come and talk to such a well-informed group. Because you each know the different aspects of the food system and the areas you're working on better than I do. Anyway, here goes. First of all, I want to forget the problems. We know what the problems are. The continuing levels of hunger, ill health related to food consumption, work exploitation, etc., etc., climate change, water. We know them. Let's take those as read. And take them together with the kind of geopolitical shifts that there are. And I think we're a bit like people in 1909. I was asked about this in a parliamentary inquiry. If you think back, well, none of us are old enough, even those of us wearing ties here, to remember 1909. But that, in 1909, you could see most of the elements that were going to shape at least the first half of the 20th century. Big geopolitical shifts, new technologies, scientific discoveries, the things that came together. But few would have predicted what happened between then and 1949. Two world wars, major depression, and so on. And today, we have those elements that are shaping the 21st century. The new geopolitical shifts, the new technologies, the revolutions in science that have changed our understanding. Yet I also fear, if we as a species and our politicians behave as they did in the last century, the potential for conflict in this one is even greater. Especially given the effort we put into developing better means of destruction. So today's challenges, I think, require us as a human race, with our many and varied and fantastic different societies, although grouped into political structures of nation states, to do something we've never managed before, except after major catastrophes, and even then rarely, like the creation of the UN after the Second World War or the welfare state. We actually have to, in a deliberative, thoughtful, interactive way, work out how to share and manage the resources of this planet fairly. Because if we don't do that, we won't be able to avoid the conflict. and actually to be prepared for all the kinds of disruptions that are going to come because of the development path that we've actually developed on over the last 200 years. And one of the reasons I think food is crucial is because that is one way we can help people everywhere come together around the need for major change, because we all need food everywhere all our lives, and we need a food system that continues to deliver that food in a sustainable and fair way. And also food really does highlight the key battles that are going on for the kind of society we're going to have. Who will have control over what? And the key question about today is not simply rewriting the rules. The rules are being rewritten, folks. They have been doing that very successfully globally for 10 years. It's whose rules in whose interests. Remember, laws and rules, they're legal fictions. They're not like laws of gravity. If I let go, it falls. Laws aren't like that. Who has the power to decide what is it? That's what we're interested in. And we know, of course, there are many voices saying we have to do things differently if we're to survive. From the Sustainable Development Commission's latest report on prosperity without growth, pointing out the madness of the economic growth philosophy for the rich countries, and the International Assessment of Agricultural Knowledge, Science and Technology for Development, really trips off the tongue, doesn't it? Arguing that the intensive industrial model farming system that we've got really has to change. So let's agree we need major change. But will we get it? And in what direction? I'm not sure our leaders show much signs of grasping that need, especially if you look at how they've responded to the financial meltdown in the kind of financial fiction capitalism that we've developed in the last 20 years particularly. And the other thing about food, of course, is we don't actually need that much of it to live a healthy life. And it kind of illustrates the kind of madness of this consumer capitalist growth of ever-increasing consumption. At an individual level, we can manage to live perfectly well on a mixture of some kinds of staples supplemented by fruits and vegetables and some protein sources. It doesn't matter whether animal or vegetable. But you don't make a lot of money out of building your whole system on that, because there's a pressure to ever increase and change and increase the money made out of food, and that's where meat consumption and other things come in. But otherwise, if we go on the way we are, like the fat man in the Monty Python films, some of you may know that, you know, you explode if you keep exploding. And a global obesity epidemic, in a sense, shows you what's happening on that. Now, I think we can characterise two different streams of the visions of the future for our food and human future. That's provided we avoid collapse. And that's still a real possibility. The release of weapons of mass destruction, major diseases and other factors could cause this highly complex but very vulnerable systems that we've developed globally to collapse. In which case it is the poor that will inherit the world, because they will survive. But the first area I think that we need to avoid, and where we need to make a better job of describing the future that's in store for us, and Pat Mooney's done this brilliantly in some of his scenario work, and if you haven't seen it, I don't think it's published yet, is it? It's a great shame, it's great stuff. But really it's about a vision of a future that is more of the same. Technological dominance is the view. We have the technology, the skills to overcome any problems we make. We'll continue the industrial model. We'll continue the corporate controlled and led approach to the future, which is more and more monocultural and homogenizing, with development being seen as more of what you see in the rich world today. And if there are problems, we have the scientific and technical brilliance to get our way out of it. Or at least the rich part of the world does, and the poor part will suffer the problems or be controlled because of the consequences. That is not a future I think is an ideal one or a desirable one, but it's one that we're heading in. And it's a future in which intellectual property rules are really crucial, because we're increasingly going to be licensed to grow seeds, to listen to music, to read books, or to breathe the air we breathe, even as we commodify everything and move everything into market relationships. It's the future of vertical farms, in vitro meat, genetically engineered organisms and geoengineered planets and synthetic biology as solutions to what are complex social, economic and political problems. And they won't work, because technology won't solve the problems. But that's where we're headed. It's kind of what I would shorthand call corporate feudalism. But we're heading that way unless we really change the paradigm. And that's the paradigm that most of us work in, I think. It's a paradigm that sees just humans as animals, part of a living biosphere that needs that to be well functioning, and sees things happening in cycles, and that sustainability means working with that flow of cycles, improving and developing on them, drawing in the traditional knowledge that we've developed over millennia through different farming practices in many parts of the world, blended in with the scientific and technical understanding we've got from the way science and technology have developed. In this we know history matters. But things are like they are because of particular histories and the way imperialism has developed, the way foods have been spread around the world. Commodity patterns are linked to past restructuring of the globe by different imperial powers. And that we've also got things very wrong about land before, from the Dust Bowl in the States in the 30s back to the Romans destroying the granaries of North Africa. So unless we use that wisdom that comes out of knowledgeable people managing to live in very diverse environments sustainably over millennia, and meld that in with the new capacities we've got, I don't think we have a chance. And I've seen it, and you've seen it in the projects you do. I saw it most recently in India, I saw it in Ethiopia. How many people know how to work in highly productive areas successfully and sustainably? It's just as Eric Holt-Germanes noticed in a recent article. There are many highly productive, equitable, sustainable alternatives to present industrial processes and corporate monopolies holding the world's food hostage, and literally millions of people working to advance those alternatives. Contrary to conventional thinking, these practices are highly productive and could easily feed the projected mid-century global population. The trouble is, they're actually complex, not simple, they're not unilinear, they're not easily mechanised, or managed with labour that has little knowledge or understanding of what it's working with. A lot of the work that we work on and see goes on, and this work goes on despite the system, not because of it. So the challenge, I think, and that's what we're going to talk about in detail today, is what do you do? How do you frame the rules in a way that makes that the norm, that supports that as the way we develop? And it's not just about the food system, because it's actually about the whole way we transform the economic and political systems. Because food, of course, is embedded deeply in that. Yet I think, as I said, food is also a beacon that can help us see our way out. So, I want to accept, and let's accept, that there is a paradigm shift we need, and that is to this kind of agroecological approach. It is both indigenous and traditional knowledge and science knowledge led together, blended together. So, then, what are the legal frameworks? What are the rules? What are the incentives and the disincentives that will move us into making that the paradigm that is operative? And then we need to be as clear as we can in the different areas we talk about the specific ones related to the experiences we're going to discuss, and have stories to tell about how practically they're actually happening, so we can tell stories at the same time as show why we can rewrite rules in a way that will deliver what we want. One of the problems I found when I worked with the NGOs in the 80s and 90s with the WDM and others was because there are so many pressing problems and so many fires to fight, everyone spends most of the time fighting those fires and not actually trying to connect together the issues and so make the individual actions more than the sum of those individual actions into a real challenge that is well backed up to the system and proposes changes that will actually deliver ways of getting over those problems. So I think one of the things we're challenged with is as organisations not to behave like consumer goods manufacturers and having a new campaign every 2 years to refresh the troops and so on, but actually we have to create space to put long-term effort into these kind of changes. And that draws on the experience of what happened in the 20 odd years that four industries spent rewriting the rules of the world of intellectual property. From 1972 they started thinking, the music, the pharmaceutical, the software and the film industry, because their business model depends on intellectual property. And it took them a long time to get these monopoly privilege rules adopted into the TRIPS agreement, trade related aspects of intellectual property rights in the World Trade Organization. And they're continuing their efforts to enforcing it and expanding it through the economic partnership agreements and FTAs. And I'm pleased to see that there's a booklet issued today by the UK Food Group looking at IP and the economic partnership agreements. So their rewriting of the rules is about a conservative and protectionist approach to protect an obsolete business model, basically. Because the kind of changes we've seen really make obsolete that kind of way of trying to control the world. So today, we're going to focus on the laws and rules, the regulations and the measures. And one of the things I found quite helpful recently in thinking about system change is a book that Donella Meadows wrote and has been published posthumously, Thinking About Systems. In her reflection on a lifetime's work, and she was the lead author of Limits to Growth in the early 70s, she talked about leverage points for change, and about a dozen of them. And she noted that many people spent most of the time working on the lowest levers, which are the least effective in getting system change, like numbers of people affected by something. Well, one of the areas you have to work on are looking at the higher level levers, which if you can shift, really shift things along. Paradigm change is one of them, and we've mentioned that. She picked another two or three, which I'll mention, and the third one we'll focus on for the rest of the day. One is about being clear about what are the goals of the system, its purpose or function. And when we're clear about that, it makes it a lot easier to argue with people about why we need change. And it's a core issue, and I think with food, as I've argued before, the goals are both complicated, multiple and interconnected, because they're about ensuring a safe, secure, sustainable, sufficient and nutritious diet for everybody, equitably. And it's these measures linked together that are the measure of whether the changes that we're seeing are good and how they should be judged. The second lever is about ensuring the capacity of systems to be self-organising, to be resilient and have a power to change and adapt and evolve. And this in turn, in a sense, means losing control, central control, corporate or state, and actually seeing that capacity for resilience and environment with an adaptation rooted in many and diverse cultures and places. And when I read that, it seems to me very closely linked to the move we're seeing from the food sovereignty and food democracy movements around the world. And it's all about ensuring that that knowledge and experience of fisher folk and farmers and pastoralists and household food provisioners, urban and rural, not just in Africa but everywhere, is brought into the way we frame the rules that we have nationally and globally. So that takes us to the third area, which are these rules. And to date it's been the powerful who've been very much involved in setting them, in their interest. But it's failed to deliver the kind of food system we described before. Because we do have persistent and continuing and growing levels of hunger, and we do have persistent problems from ill health related to consumption patterns, and we do have major questions on sustainability of the production practices we've got. So we shift that paradigm from this fossil fuel based, intensive, industrial approach to farming, and this is a very good time to do it, in which the model is serviced by ever larger companies in each of the sectors, whether it's input suppliers, seeds, fertilisers or what have you, traders, manufacturers, retailers, caterers. The kind of large elephants who are competing amongst and between themselves for who makes what out of food. And in that process, it's the little people, whether they're farmers or consumers or workers, who are under the feet. And you know what happens too if you get under the feet of elephants. So what we're looking at, and when we're talking about the different bits of the work that we're doing, we're actually talking about a whole view which is a multiple, it's diverse, it's a multi-scale, it's agroecological model. And we look at how that model and how those practices can become the norm through reshaping the rules that govern the communities and the countries and internationally, and that facilitate people and businesses to work and operate in that. It's not an anti-business model. Remember, most farmers are probably the largest number of small businesses in the world. But it's about the nature of that business. It's about whether it's corporate or individual. It's about the kind of relationships that exist. Okay. So I'll just run through a few areas where I think we need change. Okay. I can't cover all of them, and neither can we today. But in the ones that we do cover, let's be clear, and if there are areas we think we can't cover but a matter, let's identify them and highlight them for further work. So what are them? Well, the big one is economics. Really big one. Because we actually need a new conception of economics which is ecologically based. And there's plenty of work going on this. From the Sustainable Development Commission, the New Economics Foundation, the likes of Herman Daly, etc., etc. Now we can help ground that work by thinking through what it means in terms of food. Well, you're looking about sustaining sufficiency, not over-exploitation and continual increases in production. You're looking about the kind of diet that you eat, not simply assuming a trend line will go on. It requires new measures of progress and abandoning things like the simplistic GMP, which even, you know, President Sarkozy and his recent commission with Stiglitz and others on the measurement of economic and social progress, I think it's called, are critical of, as well as much more trenchant critics like David Corton, who wrote the book When Corporations Control the World. Don't know if you read it, great book. But there are imaginative proposals coming out. But the thing I noticed about Tim Jackson's report on sustainable prosperity without growth does not mention food or agriculture. No, I know, but it's people actually working in this seem to forget most of the time that actually we need a viable and vibrant food system globally. We need to think about discount rates. Basically, the future is discounted over a 20 or at most 40 years due in most ways. So there's a lot of specifics that need to be worked on economics, but let's try and think about that and use food as a way in. Another area, of course, are rules about land and access to land and use of land. Again, an area that's been very much left under the table for a long time, talk about growing reform and so on. But in today's world, it may become more important to talk about agricultural land use and the fact that we're losing a lot of the best land for China, in China and India and many places, with the kind of urban development which is following on the path that we've taken in the West. But land's about property, and that's issues about how we manage property. And one of the big changes in how we manage property is the importance of imaginary property, that it actually become more important than real things. By imaginary property, I actually mean things like intellectual property, patents, copyrights, trademarks. And the biggest shift we've seen in the last 100 years has been this extension globally of an intellectual property regime through the TRIPS agreement. And as Chris Rogers wrote in our book, as we said, I have to give you a little plug, you can look at it, please don't take it, the last conference I was, someone walked up with it on the first morning so I couldn't show it anybody. It's free to download on the internet. And if you live in Britain, please buy a copy from the publishers, they'd rather like it. As he wrote, looking at the effects of the work on Schmeiser and the Canadian judgment, imaginary property rights are being given priority over real property rights, which is a very, very big shift, so that you get your land contaminated by a product that someone has a patent on. It's not their problem, it's yours. It contradicts the polluter pays principle. So within the current framework, where we as NGOs and civil society came in far too late to understand this, and we're stuck with TRIPS rules, we have to use what flexibilities there are and prevent the extension of those, but also look beyond that to think about innovation and why that model of innovation is wrong and doesn't actually work in agriculture. We're being moved down a direction in the pharmaceutical model of innovation, when historically agriculture has been the most disseminated open access system of innovation, subsequently supported by public goods research that was designed to be freely copied and used, and has only recently been dragged into this narrow, patent-protected, corporate-led approach to innovation, a very controlled and centralist approach. And we might use Olivia de Schutter's latest report to the UN General Assembly on the right to food, because it's looking at seed policies and the right to food and innovation and agricultural biodiversity. Where he points out, amongst many other recommendations, that countries should refrain from imposing TRIPS plus conditions in free trade agreements. Maybe the EU should take note of this in its economic partnership agreements. One area I'd like to dwell on a little bit more is around science and technology and the questions of research and development and innovation. Because a great deal of the work I've seen and you're involved with, whether I've seen it in Ethiopia, I've seen it just recently in India, shows how innovative and knowledgeable different farming communities are in managing complex ecosystems and balancing risks and benefits gained from different production patterns, using biological and environmental control mechanisms to increase their power over undesirable outcomes, whether from pests or weather events. Farmers' varieties, making sure you have a yield, whereas if you went in a monocultural uniform variety where you would lose the yield unless you have very specific parameters, and so on and so forth. And they have many uses for the multiple uses for the biomass produced. But what we've seen is a move away from dealing with that. R&D, in the way it's currently structured, has focused much more narrowly and in a disciplinary way on things. And it's in fact quite simplistic. It focuses on just one or two elements of production. And it uses pesticides and fertilizers to overcome complexity and steamroller over it, rather than work with it and develop it to be more sustainable and more productive for the kind of things we want. And some interesting research from Jonathan Harwood at Manchester, who's been looking at earlier green revolutions and why they don't work for small farmers, not just in developing countries but in Europe in the early part of the 20th century. And he identifies things I'm sure you'll relate to, part because the approach is too technocratic and fails to take account of political and economic conditions in which farmers have to operate. In part because of the way research and development is conceived, often arrogant and contemptuous of the knowledge of farmers among experts, who increasingly, and moreover increasingly in developing countries, have a little connection with the farming background they're undertaking. Plus, of course, opposition from forms of R&D that would actually be easily copied or used by farmers and undermine markets of private producers. The other area is this kind of reductionist approach to science, because it's rather simplistic. Just thinking about the seed, and genetic engineering is another example of a rather simplistic approach. Although it wants to put everything into the seed and then control the use of that seed, it actually misses that complexity of an environment in which you operate. So, how do we reframe the incentives, the research structures and academic organisations to do the kind of research that actually is integrative, ecological? My soil science degree was a good basis for that, because soils are not physical, they're not chemical, they're not biological, they're all of them, and more. So, and I know there's someone here who's quite good on thinking about some of that, the way researchers are judged and rewarded has to change. We're looking at rules and laws and incentives right across the board. Of course, we're interested in power relations, social, political and commercial. And that takes us into the realm of rules on corporations themselves, what they are, what their responsibilities are. And again, there's work on that. That the vision that they only have responsibility to shareholders and the now assent has to be changed. Rules on competition, over retail concentration, for example. Other laws concern liability and redress, so that those introducing and benefiting, say, from selling technologies, face a stricter liability regime as they want on the people who might have the genetically engineered seeds unexpectedly in their fields. That would change the rapidity with which commercialisation happened, especially if it was cross-linked to a redress regime where they would have to pay for unintended consequences that may emerge down the line. This, of course, is an area in the CBD that the industry is fighting tooth and nail. Another complex area concerns how we frame rules that link nutritional well-being and dietary patterns to production, to agricultural production, and the incentives we have for different kinds of agricultural production. And I know there's a session on that, which we'll discuss that hopefully more today. But that means looking at marketing and advertising rules as well, different subsidy regimes, as well as full cost accounting. Waste is another issue, and the Food Ethics Council just had a big report on waste, which hopefully some of you saw. Of course, there are other rules around subsidies, trade and the economics of farming, because as was pointed out to me in India, and it's true in Britain in many places, it doesn't actually pay for small farmers to increase their production, because there's no market, or if they do, the benefits are squeezed out by all the middlemen in between for us on either side of them. But we also need, I know Liz, I've got to wrap up soon, to look not about products and production, but processes and power. And it's empowering people, especially women, to have control over their lives and be confident actors in their own right in putting their voices into this policy formation that's crucial. And I've just seen that really brilliantly demonstrated in the Deccan Development Society work with the Dalit Untouchable Women, illiterate women, with whom they've worked over 20 years, setting up, helping them develop sangams where they talk about what their issues are, giving them access to land and farming, but more than that, giving them a voice, through giving illiterate women videos, radio stations. And now these people are talking directly to, they've been here to talk to Diffid, they're putting this stuff out. And that's certainly something I would hope is happening, or if it isn't, should be happening in cross-connecting with the work going on with African farmers. Of course, there's a lot of stuff on international governance systems, on food and agriculture, and that's a lot of debates going on in FAO now. But the other area is about holding transnationals to account, because we actually now have a set of international actors who are beyond account, because we have accounting systems that operate nationally. But any attempt to look at the way that transnationals operate has been resisted and gone from the UN over the years. And they're very good at playing governments off against each other. We need to look at commodity trading and creating and managing real food stocks and emergency response mechanisms to deal with the crises that are definitely going to occur. And we may also maybe draw a few lessons from the promoters of an ever-increasing intellectual property monopoly regime. Their focus on enforcement. Well, it's time we looked at enforcement mechanisms for the right to food and other human rights. To hold both state and private actors to account for how far their policies and practices support or diminish these rights. And there's another area that was drawn to my attention the other day in peace studies, which is the horribly potential use, dual use of many of the modern biotechnologies or weapons technologies. Okay, I'm coming to the end. Changing systems is difficult and challenging, but it's possible. Been happening all the time. What it requires though is the connection of our forces in a much more gathered whole rather than just different ploughing different furrows. Keep ploughing the furrows but recognising we're part of a whole field and that we want to change the way that field is used and seen. But the other thing to remember if we do change the paradigm is no paradigm is wholly right. We still have to be open to thinking, yes, we will have to be flexible and move as change goes on. Two final comments from Meadows' reflections on system wisdom. It's about expanding the boundary of caring. As she said, no part of the human race is separate from other human beings or from the global ecosystem. And what we're trying to do here is spread the best we humans can do and spread it and grow it. And you have, through the experience, you've got masses of knowledge about that. So good luck as we move on to the rest of the day. The goal is to build upon the diverse and thriving well-fed world, which is there to be created, and which you know so many good examples of. So thanks, and good luck for the rest of the day.
Thank you very much, Jeff. That was a tour de force. I know a lot of material, reflection, thinking, visits, activism, talking, etc. The book he mentioned, The Future Control of Food, which he edited with Tamsin Rajot, is published by Earthscan, which he didn't mention, and you can download it, as he said, from the webpage and also order it from there. And very clearly, in what Jeff was saying, I was both trying to keep time and write notes too, there are many pointers there for not just the problem, but how we get towards the kind of solutions we want. What are the levers for change?